I am Dr. Rapp, and this is Appreciating Shakespeare, Series 2, Podcast J, Hamlet. Hamlet being Shakespeare's longest play, as well as one of his greatest, this podcast devoted to it will also be longer than others. Having said that, I will begin with an ironic contradiction. "There is less to be said about Hamlet than has been said," quipped American poet and scholar J.V. Cunningham. The reason he is right is that so much said and written about the play has been wrong. It is not about a man who could not make up his mind, as the voiceover introduction to Olivier's film in 1948 asserted. It is not about a man with an Oedipal complex, as the Freudian biographer Ernest Jones would have it. It is not about a 20th century existentialist who thinks too much, or about a madman, or about someone too passionate or too rational or incapable of deciding whether to be a scholar or a soldier or suicidal. The character Hamlet is not meant to be too mysterious to be comprehended, nor the play Hamlet too multifaceted to have a clear meaning. Only someone laboring under the weight of these wrong ideas could think the play a dramatic failure, as T.S. Eliot thought it was. Hamlet is the dramatized story of an intelligent man, both rational and passionate, in a particular time and place, whose free will is caught between the moral law and the pressures of the morally corrupt world. Because of a bad habit of mind, the man goes wrong, and his error leads to tragedy. However, thanks to providential circumstances, his will is corrected before it is too late, that is, before he dies. The trajectory of his moral growth is so deeply portrayed that it becomes universally representative, relevant to any human being in any time and place. The form of drama in which this trajectory is conveyed is the revenge tragedy, a popular form of Renaissance entertainment. Specifically, a ghost gives Hamlet the task of avenging his father's death. He is told to do it without tainting his mind. This turns the task into a profound moral dilemma, which can only be resolved by an equally profound moral breakthrough. Vengeance is always a problem for man. In the European aristocratic tradition, a nobleman is obligated to exact vengeance upon the murderer of his kin. In the Judeo-Christian biblical tradition, one can enact that vengeance only as an instrument of divine justice, for, as we read in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 35, "Vengeance and recompense are mine." And in Romans chapter 12, verse 19, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." Hamlet, the greatest of all plays in the tradition of revenge tragedy, is a response to and a commentary on the very popular revenge play called The Spanish Tragedy by Thomas Kyd. That play was itself built on the model of the plays of the ancient Roman tragedian, Seneca. In Kyd's play, as in Seneca, the context of the drama is the afterlife as imagined by the ancient classical world. The dead cross the river Styx and go to Hades to be judged by Minos and Rhadamanthus, and it is Pluto and Proserpine who send a ghost back to Earth to invite the living relative of the murdered man to avenge the man's death. In this way, the moral problem of revenge in a Christian context is avoided. The aristocratic ethos prevails. In Hamlet, Shakespeare takes upon himself a much greater challenge: to examine the problem of revenge, including aristocratic revenge, in the context of the afterlife in which Shakespeare and his Christian audience actually believed. In the universe pictured by Christianity, when a person dies, his or her soul faces the judgment of God, and the consequences will certainly be either heaven or hell. In that context, the problem of revenge becomes an instance of the universal problem. How is man to do the right thing in a morally complex situation whose backdrop is the divine judgment? Hence, the first question for the character Hamlet is whether the ghost is an emissary from God or a temptation from the devil. The first half of the play is devoted to Hamlet's attempt to find the answer to that question. To find it, Hamlet does two things. He pretends to be mad, and will continue to do so, even when he knows the ghost has told the truth, and he mounts a play within the play to detect the guilt, if any, of Claudius. Pretending to be mad is also part of the revenge play tradition, and is central to the Spanish tragedy. The avenger needs to investigate the possibly guilty parties while not giving away that he knows from a ghost that there has been a murder. Hamlet, too, pretends to be mad. He is never mad, in fact, though Shakespeare has him playing at madness in several different moods and in two forms. Sometimes Hamlet is in a calm mood and pretending to be mad. At Act 2, Scene 2, lines 174 to 420, he says things like this to Polonius: "Excellent, Will, you are a fishmonger." Sometimes he is furious, always for good cause, and also pretending to be mad. At Act 3, Scene 1, lines 102 to 149, he says to Ophelia things like, "Get thee to a nunnery." And at Act 5, Scene 1, lines 254 to 283, things like this to Laertes: "Swoons, show me what thou do. Would weep, would fight, would fast, would tear thyself, eat a crocodile?" Hamlet's performance of madness is complicated also by his pretending to two different forms of madness: the madness a man may be driven to by thwarted ambition, and the madness he may be driven to by thwarted love, both classic forms of stage madness. The former, thwarted ambition madness, is evoked by the ambition talk of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern at Act 2, Scene 2, line 252, and is exemplified by Hamlet saying, "I am most dreadfully attended," at line 269. The latter, thwarted love madness, is evoked by Ophelia's rejection of his love tokens and is exemplified in Ophelia's description of him at Act 2, Scene 1, line 74 and following: "Lord Hamlet, with his doublet all unbraced, no hat upon his head, his stockings fouled, ungartered and down-jived to his ankle, pale as his shirt, his knees knocking each other, and with a look so piteous in purport as if he had been loosed out of hell to speak of horrors." This description gives a classic picture of the man dejected by disappointment in love. As Hamlet intended, Polonius is taken in by that pretense, for he says, at line 82, "Mad for thy love," and later at Act 3, Scene 1, lines 176 to 178, "But yet I do believe the origin and commencement of his grief sprung from neglected love." But whatever his mood, and whatever the form of madness he is pretending to, Hamlet tells us early, late, and often that his madness, which at Act 1, Scene 5, line 172, he calls an antic disposition, is only put on, play-acted. At Act 2, Scene 2, line 290, he interrupts his madness act to tell us that he is aware of how others are trying to deceive him. Aside, "Nay, then, I have an eye of you." And at Act 3, Scene 4, lines 187 to 188, he repeats to his mother that he is mad only in craft. There is real madness depicted in the play, but it is the madness of Ophelia in Act 4, Scene 5. Hamlet is never actually mad. The second method of Hamlet's investigation, in addition to pretending to be mad, is to mount a play within the play. The purpose of the play that Hamlet orders to be performed, and for which he writes a few lines, though we never know which, is to determine whether the ghost has spoken the truth about Claudius. Though on first hearing the ghost's words, Hamlet at Act 1, Scene 5, line 31, wanted to sweep to his revenge, on second thought, he realizes, in Act 2, Scene 2, lines 598 to 603, that "the spirit that I have seen may be a devil that abuses me to damn me." The "to be or not to be" speech at Act 3, Scene 1, lines 55 and following, articulates that the fear of judgment after death and the consequent possibility of hell prevents people in general from rushing to do things, like revenge, that might satisfy their desire but could get them damned as a consequence. The two soliloquies, 1 at Act 2, Scene 2, lines 550 and following, "Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I," and the "to be or not to be" soliloquy in the next scene, both address the same question, the former personally and emotionally, the latter generally and rationally. The word "question" in the first line of the latter soliloquy, from the Latin quaestio, means a topic to be discussed by considering both a hypothesis and its refutation, as was done by divinity students in the medieval and Renaissance universities like Wittenberg, where Hamlet and Horatio have been at school. The two soliloquies lead to the same conclusion, the first particular, the second general. Hamlet chooses to refrain from killing Claudius until he is sure it is the right thing to do, lest he be damned for doing it. This is not indecision, as many modern critics would have us believe. It is rational wisdom. The Murder of Gonzago play, which at Act 3, Scene 2, line 237, Hamlet jestingly calls the mousetrap, proves to the satisfaction of both Hamlet and his rational friend Horatio that the king is in fact guilty. This brings Hamlet to the climax and turning point of the play, the remarkable double soliloquy scene, Act 3, Scene 3. The soliloquy of Claudius first confirms for the audience that Claudius is guilty of murdering his brother. Hamlet, who cannot of course hear that soliloquy as the audience can, then chooses to postpone the killing. Why? Out of indecision? Out of compassion for a man at prayer? Out of cowardice? Not for any of these hypothetical motives critics have posited. Hamlet's own soliloquy reveals explicitly the actual reason for his choice, and the reason is an evil one. It constitutes Hamlet's fall and the cause of the tragedy. Knowing now that Claudius is guilty, Hamlet assumes that the kneeling Claudius is repenting. Hamlet chooses not to execute Claudius when the soul of a repentant Claudius might go to heaven. He decides to wait in order to kill Claudius when Claudius is doing something evil, so that his soul will be damned. In other words, to satisfy his personal desire for revenge, Hamlet is playing God. Hamlet's potential for making this tragic error was prepared for earlier in the play. In Act 1, Scene 2, Hamlet complains about the haste of the marriage of his mother to his hated uncle. About the wedding day, Hamlet says, at lines 182 to 183, "Would I had met my dearest foe in heaven, or ever I had seen that day, Horatio." That is, to Hamlet, the next to worst thing of all would be to see his worst enemy saved instead of damned. The worst thing of all would be to see his mother marry his uncle. This attitude toward one's enemy would have been seen by Shakespeare's Christian audience as a moral flaw, not yet a sin, but a sinful habit of mind. They would have recognized it as understandable, but wrong. Why? Because a good Christian would want to see his enemy in heaven. It would mean that the enemy had repented before dying, and Christ commanded his followers to love their enemies and to forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors, as the Paternoster, the Lord's Prayer, has it in Matthew chapter 6, verse 12. At Act 1, Scene 4, lines 23 and following, Hamlet has meditated on the idea that a single flaw in a man's character may result in his damnation, no matter how great his other virtues. The fear is a real one, and Hamlet will himself illustrate it by taking corruption from this particular fault, the desire never to see his enemy in heaven. It is this dram of evil in Hamlet's character that leads to his fall in Act 3, Scene 3, when he decides to wait to kill the king in order to be sure the king will go to hell when killed. Between Hamlet's ghost-communicated mission and its execution has stepped Hamlet's personal desire for ultimate revenge. Would it be right for Hamlet to kill the king in Act 3, Scene 3, when Claudius seems to be praying, considering that everything goes wrong because Hamlet does not do it? It would be right. Hamlet is, in fact, the rightful king of Denmark, since his uncle, were it known, would be disqualified for having stolen the crown by murdering Hamlet's father. In the play, as in history, Denmark is an elective monarchy. That is, the monarch does not automatically inherit the throne, but is chosen from among members of the royal family by aristocratic electors. It is presumably Hamlet's obligation, knowing Claudius to be guilty, to kill him. For Hamlet is in fact the only rightful executor of justice in Denmark. It seems that Providence has set up this moment of Claudius's vulnerability after the play within the play that has publicly demonstrated his guilt, precisely so that Hamlet could easily execute him. Also, Hamlet's task of avenging his father's murder has been conveyed to him by a ghost who is now known to be honest, that is, sent from heaven, not from hell. However, in Act 1, Scene 5, lines 84 to 85, the ghost had added a stipulation. Howsomever thou pursues this act, taint not thy mind. That is, take revenge without tainting your mind with evil or sin. Thus the play raises this question. How is it possible to take revenge, which belongs to God, without tainting one's mind with sin? To see the sense in the play's answer, let us ask the question like this. Is the avenger killing the villain out of personal vengeance, or as the instrument of the divine justice, of the vengeance that is mine, saith the Lord? The answer is that Hamlet might have acted as divine instrument in either of two ways, as a result of passion or as a result of reason. It is Hamlet's nature that he flies into passions and then becomes reasonable again. This is a pattern revealed in Hamlet's soliloquies as well as in dialogue. He is in a passion in the soliloquy at Act 1, Scene 2, lines 129 and following, "Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt," but concludes with rational self-control, "But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue," at line 159. He is in a passion after the ghost speaks to him in Act 1, Scene 5, "O most pernicious woman, O villain, villain, smiling, damned villain." But he is calmly rational by the end of the scene. "Rest, rest, perturbed spirit," meaning the ghost. "The time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right." In the soliloquy at Act 2, Scene 2, lines 550 and following, he flies into a passionate rage. "Bloody, bawdy villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain." But turns himself around with, "Why, what an ass am I," at line 582, and concludes with calm reason at line 604 to 605. "The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king." This pattern of passion replaced by reason remains characteristic of Hamlet's personality throughout. It still applies in Act 5, Scene 1, when he rages at Laertes, "Would weep, would fight, would fast, would tear thyself," and then becomes calm and rational again at lines 283 to 284 and 288 to 290. "Nay, an thou'lt mouth, I'll rant as well as thou. Hear you, sir, what is the reason that you use me thus? I loved you ever." Thus, had Hamlet's calm but false reasoning not obstructed his natural passion, he might have killed the king at Act 3, Scene 3, at line 73 to 75. "Now might I do it, Pat, now he is a-praying, and now I'll do it, and so he goes to heaven, and so am I revenged." That is, his passionate nature might have been the very instrument that the divine revenge chose to use to punish Claudius. What prevented heaven's using Hamlet's passion as its instrument at that moment was Hamlet's free will, which obstructed that course with false reason, in the form of his decision to wait until he were sure Claudius would be damned when Hamlet did kill him. Alternatively to a passionate outburst, Hamlet might have correctly reasoned himself into killing Claudius. Had he been concerned with justice in Denmark rather than with his own personal desire for revenge, he might with perfect justice have executed the murderer of the previous king. It was, after all, his task given by the ghost and by his position as the rightful king of Denmark. But instead of using his reason correctly, he uses reason to justify the perverse intention not merely to kill the king, but to be certain he would be damned. This is an instance of just what Hamlet accuses his mother of doing in the next scene, Act 3, Scene 4 at line 88, when he says that her reason panders will. That is, the higher human function of reason has served as a pimp for the lower human will. We would call it rationalization, the mind justifying what it knows to be wrong in order to satisfy some desire. Hamlet fails on both counts, passion and reason. He fails because his mind is tainted by the desire to be certain that Claudius be not merely killed, but damned. This is an evil desire, a sin of pride, no service to God or to Denmark, but a worship of one's own fallible self. The climax and turning point of the whole play is a tiny two-letter word in Act 3, Scene 3, to which Shakespeare gives an entire line of verse. "And am I then revenged to take him in the purging of his soul when he is fit and seasoned for his passage? No." Or we might say, "No, ba-bum, 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 ba-bum." Hamlet's fall lies in that one word, no. With that word, he substitutes for his mission his own personal desire. His personal desire for revenge takes the place of his mission as rightful avenger that was given him by God through the ghost. Having heard the ghost describe as most horrible the fact of being sent unshriven to purgatory, that's at Act 1, Scene 5, line 80, he now wills Claudius to be sent unshriven to hell. Hamlet's error is punctuated by the dramatic irony of the scene, Act 3, Scene 3. After Hamlet's departure, Claudius tells us, at lines 97 to 98, that he is not, in fact, penitent after all. "My crown, mine own ambition, and my queen," listed at line 55, "were desires too strong to permit him to repent," so that he concludes, "My words fly up, my thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go." So if Hamlet had killed Claudius just now, Claudius would likely have been damned, though not by Hamlet's will, but only by God's. Because of Hamlet's choice to damn rather than merely to kill Claudius, everything goes wrong. In the next scene, Act 3, Scene 4, having failed to kill Claudius at the perfect moment for it to be done, Hamlet kills Polonius by mistake. Having pretended to see through the kneeling gesture of Claudius into his presumably repenting but in fact impenitent soul, Hamlet now fails to see a man's external identity through a mere physical arras, meaning a hanging tapestry. He falsely assumes, at line 32, that it is the king, not Polonius, behind the arras, "I took thee for thy better," and flies into the kind of passion that might have caused him to kill Claudius in the previous scene. These two errors, the physical error in this scene resulting from the moral error in the previous scene, are disastrous for Denmark. Let me remind you about the doctrine of the two bodies of the king, which I discussed in Session 2 of Chapter 7 in Series 1. Hamlet, given the guilt of Claudius, is Denmark, and therefore, as Laertes says at Act 1, Scene 3, lines 20 to 21, on his choice depends the safety and health of this whole state. Thus, the results of Hamlet's one-syllable word no in Act 3, Scene 3 are, apart from the eventual death of Claudius, that Ophelia goes mad and dies, that Laertes plots with Claudius against Hamlet and dies, that Gertrude mistakenly drinks the poison meant by Claudius for Hamlet and dies, that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern die, and of course that Hamlet, murdered by the avenger Laertes, dies. Thus the whole tragedy springs from Hamlet's one-word fall. However, by the time of all these disastrous consequences in the physical world of the court, an entirely different transformation has taken place within the soul of Hamlet. In the soliloquy at Act 4, Scene 4, lines 32 and following, "How all occasions do inform against me," Hamlet appears at his lowest and most confused. That soliloquy is the source of the idea that Hamlet is a coward, or thinks too much, or cannot make up his mind, because critics mistakenly generalize from these words to the whole play. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion, or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, meaning the outcome, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom, and ever three parts coward, I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody, or be nothing worth. But the truth is that we, the audience, do know why Hamlet has not done this thing, meaning killing Claudius. We have seen why he chose not to do it at the perfect moment for him to do it. And in fact, he did act to do it, as he thought, in Act 3, Scene 4, only it was the wrong man behind the arras. Hamlet's conclusion that his thoughts must be bloody or worthless are unworthy of him at his best. The whole speech conveys that Hamlet is laboring in error, incapable of figuring out what he should do, because he has not yet realized his error at the climactic moment of Act 3, Scene 3. And then a transformation happens. There is a deep transformation in Hamlet's attitude, and two kinds of experience work to cause it. The first experience, which is revealed in Act 5, Scene 1, actually happens later in time. It is the combination of Hamlet's general pondering of man's mortality and his discovery of the death of Ophelia. The contemplation in the graveyard in Act 5, Scene 1, moves from the abstract deaths of lawyers and landowners, of Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, to the death of someone Hamlet knew long ago, namely Yorick, to the shocking death of Hamlet's beloved, Ophelia. The contemplation of the skull is a classic image of memento mori. That is Latin for remember that you die. Almost any medieval saint or monk shown in his study was likely to be depicted with a skull on his desk, a reminder of his mortality. Then that general truth of mortality, arising from his contemplation of the skull of Yorick, is brought home to Hamlet by the funeral procession for Ophelia. The fruit of this scene is what every instance of memento mori intends to inspire, namely, humility. The second kind of experience is all the providential events of the sea voyage taken together, which have already happened by Act 5, Scene 1, but are not made entirely known to the audience until the private conversation between Hamlet and Horatio in Act 5, Scene 2. Those events include the following. 1. On his way to England, to be killed, as only the audience knows, Hamlet happens not to be able to sleep. 2. Hamlet feels an impulse to steal and read the letter of Claudius to the King of England, in which he discovers he is to be executed by the English king. 3. Hamlet happens to have learned in his youth how to write in formal court handwriting. 4. Hamlet happens to have his father's royal signet ring with him. 5. After rewriting the letter, which now says that the bearers are to be put to death, and then secretly replacing it, Hamlet's ship happens to be attacked by pirates. 6. Hamlet jumps aboard the pirate ship to fight them, proving he is no coward. 7. The ships happen to drift apart, with only Hamlet on board the pirate ship. 8. The pirates happen to be merciful to him in return for his putting in a good word for them to Claudius, and they take him back to Denmark. We know that Shakespeare means us to think of all these events as providential, because Hamlet says so. In recounting the events to Horatio in Act 5, Scene 2, line 48, Hamlet says, "Why, even in that was heaven ordinant." That is, Hamlet understands that there is a higher will than his that arranges the events of his life. He expresses this recognition to Horatio thus at lines 7 to 11. rashly, and praised be rashness for it, let us know our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plots do pall, and that should learn us, meaning teach us, there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will. Notice the double sense of ends here, goals and deaths. Then he goes on to describe what he did rashly, that is, on impulse, namely, getting up from his cabin, stealing the letter, etc. Hamlet's philosophical parenthetical reveals that his attitude is utterly changed from what it was in Act 3, Scene 3. There he was getting in heaven's way and trying to shape the end of Claudius toward damnation. Now he is humbled before the will of heaven. The lines resolve poetically the always paradoxical relation of man's free will to God's will. Sometimes this paradox is expressed as free will versus predestination, or free will versus fate. Shakespeare has Hamlet use a simple metaphor to express the essence of this paradox. It is the metaphor of rough-hewing a rock or a block of wood and then shaping it. What actually appears in a sculpture is the result of both rough-hewing and shaping. What actually happens in life is the result of the rough-hewing of our lives by our human will and the ultimate fine shaping of them by the divine will. At line 11, Hamlet's moral breakthrough is confirmed by the rational Horatio. That is most certain. At the end of the play, Hamlet still can fly into a passion for cause. We see this not only with Laertes at Act 5, Scene 1, but even with Horatio. When, in a moment of uncharacteristic passion himself, Horatio tries to drink of the leftover poison, Hamlet at lines 342 to 343 is roused to stop him. As thou art a man, give me the cup. Let go, by heaven I'll have it. Thus we find that the transformation in Hamlet is not a change of personality. He is still and always a man who can fly into a passion when there is cause for it, and then grow reasonable. But he is changed in the relation of his will to reality. In Act 5, Scene 2, when Hamlet has a dark and, as it turns out, true premonition about the coming fencing match, and Horatio offers to postpone the match, Hamlet says no, because we defy augury, line 219. Augury means foretelling, and the word defy here is used as it is when we say that something defies description. That is, we human beings cannot be augured about. No one knows the future. Our deaths are a function of the special providence that governs even the fall of a sparrow, lines 219 to 222, a reference to Jesus' words in Matthew chapter 10, verse 29. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, and one of them shall not fall on the ground without your father? Hamlet's conclusion, let be, means two things at once. One meaning is superficial and practical. Let's stop talking because people are coming. The other is a profound expression of Hamlet's corrected will. Let happen whatever heaven wills to happen. These short prose speeches are the sign of a complete moral transformation in Hamlet from the willful attempt to cause the damnation of Claudius in Act 3, Scene 3, to a thorough surrender to the divine will. The complex structure of the play includes a series of foils for Hamlet's moral trajectory. The foil quality of Fortinbras comes early. He sets off willfully to retake land his father lost, is recalled by his uncle King, a good but weak foil for the strong but evil Claudius, repents, receives rebuke, as reported at Act 2, Scene 2, line 69, and then sets off to Poland under proper commission. His reward for surrendering his own will to the higher will of his king is that on his return from victory, all of Denmark falls into his lap. The foil journey of Laertes comes late. Out of a desire for revenge, he puts himself into the service of the murderous Claudius, and only with his impending death repents and asks for and offers forgiveness. Horatio's similar journey is even later. Rational and balanced throughout, even he is tempted to sin by the power of his passion of grief when he tries to be more an antique Roman than a Dane, at Act 5, Scene 2, line 341, by trying to commit suicide. Recalled from that rash act by Hamlet, he then fulfills his true function to tell Hamlet's story. Even Osric is a foil for Hamlet, for at Act 5, Scene 2, line 92, when Hamlet asks Osric to put on his hat, inappropriate to be worn in the presence of the prince, Osric is caught between duty to the custom, which exists to honor the prince, and duty to the prince himself. It is an exact though comical equivalent to Hamlet's being asked to avenge his father's murder without tainting his mind. Like Hamlet in Act 3, Scene 3, Osric makes the wrong choice, deciding to serve his own picture of reality instead of the prince's picture. Osric has falsely presumed that Hamlet is mad, just as, in Act 3, Scene 3, Hamlet falsely presumed Claudius was repenting. The philosophical heart of the play, which prepares us to comprehend the healing transformation in the soul of Hamlet, is Hamlet's own speeches to the players at Act 3, Scene 2, lines 1 and following. The performance of a play on a stage is akin to living a life. Shakespeare's theater was called the Globe. Hence, in addition to being very good advice to all actors from the experienced actor-playwright Shakespeare, Hamlet's speech may be read for its universal implications. Do not overdo your part. Do not underperform, either. Do not be tardy in performing it. Don't add lines that aren't yours to say. Suit the action to the word to the action. We may wish to hear that instruction as an echo of the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 1, where word, a translation of the Greek logos, which gives us logic and all ologies, refers to God and his laws of life bestowed on man for man's own ultimate good. As the players must suit their actions to the playwright's words, Hamlet, and every one of us, must suit our actions to the capital W word, the logos, the logic of divinity. In Act 3, Scene 3, Hamlet fails every one of his strictures to the players. He overdoes his part, playing God, not God's avenger. He is tardy in performing his role. He writes lines not set down for him by the divine playwright, deciding not merely to kill the villain, but to make sure of his damnation. He fails in readiness. But by the end of the play, Hamlet has learned his lesson and has let his rough hewing become the instrument of the divine shaping. Hamlet's last words to the players are, "Go make you ready." Later, in Act 5, Scene 2 at line 222, once he himself has been made morally ready, enlightened by the humbling events of the sea voyage and the memento mori of Act 5, Scene 1, Hamlet says to Horatio, "The readiness is all." The truth of Hamlet's words is sealed, and the evidence of his having been utterly cured of his evil will is confirmed as he is dying in the last scene. Like a good Christian, he is able to forgive his own murderer. "Exchange forgiveness with me," says Laertes at line 329. Hamlet replies, "Heaven make thee free of it." Now let's look at two key lines of the play, or rather a key concept and then a key line. 1. Imperatives. The play is filled with an unusual number of imperatives, tasks given by one character to another. In many of them, there is a stipulation about how the task is to be done. The central example initiates the entire plot of the play. It is the ghosts to Hamlet. "Revenge my foul and most unnatural murder, but taint not thy mind," at Act 1, Scene 5, lines 25 and 84 to 85. All other imperatives in the play are foils for this one. Among many others, Claudius to Cornelius and Voltimand at Act 1, Scene 2, lines 33 to 38. "We here dispatch you, good Cornelius, and you, Voltimand, for bearers of this greeting to old Norway, giving you no further personal power to business with the king more than the scope of these delated articles allow." That is, do it a certain way, and do not overdo it. The same is explicit in Hamlet's speeches to the players at the start of Act 3, Scene 2. Polonius gives the famous golden mean lecture to Laertes at Act 1, Scene 3, lines 58 and following, tells Ophelia to drop Hamlet at lines 131 to 135, and gives orders to Rinaldo in Act 2, Scene 1. Tasks are given by Old Norway to Fortinbras, by Claudius to Gertrude, to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, to Laertes, by Hamlet to Horatio, to Gertrude, to Osric. The second line of the play is an imperative. Answer me, stand and unfold yourself. And so is the last line of the play. Go bid the soldiers shoot. The point is that all the imperatives in the play recreate Hamlet's position in little, the position of every human being. You are given a task to do. You are expected to do it appropriately without overdoing it, and will be judged by whether and how it is accomplished. What the trajectory of Hamlet's inner life shows us is that Providence gives us more than one chance to get it right. 2. At Act 5, Scene 2, line 58, Hamlet says about the deaths of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, "They are not near my conscience." Some critics have thought that Hamlet ought to feel more guilt over the deaths of the two schoolfellows. In accusing Hamlet of a cavalier lack of compassion, they overlook four crucial points. 1. Hamlet, being the rightful king, has the right and the duty to care for the well-being of Denmark, which involves the responsibility for executing traitors, including those loyal to the state's actual enemy, namely Claudius. 2. Unlike with Claudius in Act 3, Scene 3, Hamlet is not attempting to assign the souls of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to heaven or to hell. He is merely preventing them from seeing to Hamlet's own death, that is, the unjust murder of their rightful king. Though their lives will be ended by his forged order, their souls will be subject to God's judgment, not to Hamlet's. 3. Hamlet has every reason to believe that his two supposed friends, who serve Claudius and have lied to him, are in on the plot to kill him. He has said earlier, at Act 3, Scene 4, line 203, that he will trust them as he will adders fanged. 4. When Hamlet is writing the commission that will lead to the deaths of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, he believes that he too, along with them, will soon be appearing before England's king. He has no idea that there will be a pirate ship, or that he will be separated from the Danish ship on its way to England. The deaths of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are not near Hamlet's conscience. Here the word conscience means the awareness of having done wrong, because they arise only from Hamlet's attempt to save his own life, that is, the life of Denmark's rightful king. Now here are three specific notes to help you in your reading. 1. Ophelia's madness can be understood by seeing the situation from her viewpoint. She loves Hamlet, who appears to love her. Her brother goes to Paris. Her father tells her to drop her lover. She obeys, and her doing so drives her lover mad, as she and her father think. After exhibiting his madness, seeming to accuse her of infidelity, and instructing her to go to a nunnery, her lover kills her father in a fit of madness. All this is too much for her to bear and drives her mad. Hers is a real form of the disappointed in love madness that Hamlet was merely play-acting in Act 2, Scene 1. 2. Is Ophelia guilty of committing suicide? The question is debated in Act 5, Scene 1, comically by the two gravediggers, starting at line 1, and seriously by Laertes and the Doctor of Divinity, at lines 235 to 242. The truth is that they are debating two positions on a question to which the answer cannot be known by human beings. To know the spiritual state of another soul is not within the human purview, and every pretense of knowing it results in error. Whether Ophelia's free will chose her own death, or whether her free will was so impaired by madness that it had no part in her death, cannot be known this side of the afterlife. The gravedigger comically and the doctor of divinity seriously are both pretentious in arguing that Ophelia should not be buried in consecrated ground because she took her own life. They cannot know what was the actual choice of her free will. Similarly, Laertes is pretentious in asserting that the Doctor of Divinity will be damned and Ophelia become a ministering angel, line 241. Incidentally, Laertes' line is in large part responsible for the erroneous modern idea that the souls of the saved actually become angels in the afterlife. Laertes is being hyperbolical and metaphorical. He is not asserting a theological heresy. These two debates throw light back on Hamlet's error in Act 3, Scene 3, when he assumed that he could know and determine the eternal fate of the soul of Claudius. 3. At Act 5, Scene 2, lines 165 to 167, Osric says, "The king, sir, hath laid, sir, that in a dozen passes between yourself and Laertes, he shall not exceed you 3 hits. He hath laid on 12 for 9. The key to understanding this fencing match lies in understanding that a pass means not a bout, but a specific attack, which at this time was made as one fencer ran past his opponent, putting his point in line and creating a right-of-way that required a parry, that is, a block, and potentially a riposte, that is, a counterattack. The pass may result in a touch, that is, a hit, scored by either fencer, or in no hit at all. By contrast, a bout is some agreed-upon number of passes. Thus, the king has bet that, 1, in any one bout of 12 passes, Laertes will not score above 3 hits more than Hamlet scores, and 2, that for every 12 hits scored by Laertes in any number of bouts, Hamlet will score at least 9 hits. I am Dr. Rapp, and this is Appreciating Shakespeare.